Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 202. It's Monday, March 13th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, I haven't done too much COVID reporting recently, but I can say today, COVID is in the house. Yep, I've got COVID as we speak. Perhaps a little bit poetically, my positive test fell on the third anniversary, which was last Saturday, of the World Health Organization's declaration of COVID-19 as a worldwide pandemic. But I am happy to report I should be able to do my public health duty and be able to avoid passing it on. So COVID ends with me. Job well done. Now, I normally don't give a behind-the-scenes view of Just for the Health of You today, but I'll spare you the gritty details. But I would say COVID-19 is definitely worth avoiding. It almost killed this episode. And to sum up, I would say you couldn't pay me to work today. Fortunately, I am not being paid. And as I like to say, I am unemployable, partly because nobody can pay me what I'm worth, and partly because I prefer giving it away. Okay, well, let's start off with one COVID story. This is a larger story from the Washington Post. I'm only going to do a short summary of it and a couple things that tie into Ohio. This is COVID backlash hobbles public health and future pandemic response. When the next pandemic sweeps the United States, health officials in Ohio won't be able to shutter businesses or schools, even if they become epicenters of outbreaks. Nor will they be empowered to force Ohioans who have been exposed to go into quarantine. State officials in North Dakota are barred from directing people to wear masks to slow the spread. Not even the president can force federal agencies to issue vaccination or testing mandates to thwart its march. The result, public health experts warn, is a battered patchwork system that makes it harder for leaders to protect the country from infectious diseases that cross red and blue state borders. One day we're going to have a really bad global crisis and a pandemic far worse than COVID, and we'll look to the government to protect us, but it'll have its hands behind its back and a blindfold on, said Lawrence Gostin, director of Georgetown University's Institute for National and Global Health Law. We'll die with our rights on. We want liberty, but we don't want protection. The consequences are already playing out in Columbus, Ohio, where a child with measles was able to wander around a mall before showing symptoms in November, potentially spreading the highly contagious disease. The state legislature in 2021 had stripped the city health commissioner's ability to order someone suspected of having infectious disease to quarantine. So I'd reported a lot on that measles outbreak, and I was not aware that they knew somebody who had measles, but they weren't able to quarantine them, and they just wandered around the mall. So there you go. Columbus Health Commissioner Mashika Roberts bemoans the basic public health function she has lost control of, such as the ability to shut down a restaurant with a hepatitis A outbreak, as she had done before COVID. All the other workers exposed preparing food for others to eat, they could continue to go to work and shed hepatitis A under the new legislation, she said. Hepatitis A is fairly common and it's very contagious, and it happens in those settings, usually foodborne, where you get somebody who's preparing food who's infected. Health departments do restaurant inspections for a lot of things, but if they identify a hepatitis A outbreak, they can't even shut the place down until they get it all sorted out. So I think that's a loss. Too bad. Okay, well, let's switch to some chronic disease reporting here, a risk factor for chronic disease. This from the World Health Organization. Massive efforts needed to reduce salt intake and protect lives. A first-of-its-kind World Health Organization global report on sodium intake reduction shows that the world is off track to achieve its global target of reducing sodium intake by 30% by 2025. Sodium increases the risk of heart disease, stroke, and premature death when eaten in excess. The main source of sodium is table salt, sodium chloride, but it also is contained in other condiments such as sodium glutamate. The report shows that only 5% of WHO member states are protected by mandatory and comprehensive sodium reduction policies, and 73% of member states lack full range of implementation of such policies. Implementing highly cost-effective sodium reduction policies could save an estimated 7 million lives globally by 2030. It is an important component of action to achieve the Sustainable Development Goal target of reducing deaths from non-communicable diseases. But today, only 9 countries, Brazil, Chile, Czech Republic, Lithuania, Malaysia, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Spain, and Uruguay, have a comprehensive package of recommended policies to reduce sodium intake. Unhealthy diets are a leading cause of death and disease globally, and excessive sodium intake is one of the main culprits, said Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, WHO Director General. This report shows that most countries are yet to adopt any mandatory sodium reduction policies, leaving their people at risk of heart attack, stroke, and other health problems. WHO calls on all countries to implement the best buys for sodium reduction, and on manufacturers to implement the WHO benchmarks for sodium content in food. A comprehensive approach to sodium reduction includes adopting mandatory policies and the WHO's 4 best buy interventions related to sodium, which greatly contribute to preventing non-communicable diseases. These 4 best buys include 1. Reformulating foods to contain less salt and setting targets for the amount of sodium in foods and meals. 2. Establishing public food procurement policies to limit salt or sodium-rich foods in public institutions, such as hospitals, schools, workplaces, and nursing homes. 3. Front-of-package labeling that helps consumers select products lower in sodium. 4. Behavior change communication and mass media campaigns to reduce salt and sodium consumption. Countries are encouraged to establish sodium content targets for processed foods in line with the WHO global sodium benchmarks and enforce them through these policies. Mandatory sodium reduction policies are more effective as they achieve broader coverage and safeguard against commercial interests while providing a level playing field for food manufacturers. As part of the report, WHO developed a sodium country scorecard for member states based on the type and number of sodium reduction policies they have in place. The global average salt intake is estimated to be 10.8 grams per day, more than double the WHO recommendation of less than 5 grams of salt per day, or 1 teaspoon. Now, you have to convert that to sodium, because salt is sodium chloride, which is only like 40% by weight sodium. So that 5 grams of salt per day, or 1 teaspoon, is actually 2,300 milligrams of sodium. And actually, experts recommend that if you can bring it under 1,500 milligrams, that's all the better. Eating too much salt makes it a top risk factor for diet and nutrition-related deaths. More evidence is emerging documenting links between high sodium intake and increased risk to other health conditions, such as gastric cancer, obesity, osteoporosis, and kidney disease. And next up, an article that gets at the medicalization of all of our health problems. This from Medical Express. Study finds residual inflammation after statin therapy strongly predicts cardiovascular events and death. And this is a long article. If you're interested in all the details about the statin therapy and stuff, go to it and read it. I'll give you the link later in the show. But I love the last line. This is like pages long article. The last sentence is, beyond statins and consideration of anti-inflammatory agents, physicians should not lose sight of diet, exercise, and smoking cessation, all of which lower vascular inflammation and save lives. So the bottom line of this study is that inflammation, what they're calling residual inflammation, was a better predictor of heart disease than LDL cholesterol, which is the bad cholesterol. So this inflammation has been proposed as sort of a unifying hypothesis for a lot of disease processes, in this case, cardiovascular disease. And in this case, it seems a better predictor than even cholesterol level, partly because it interacts with cholesterol, like oxidizing cholesterol makes it even much more dangerous and heart disease producing. And next up, an interesting connection to heart disease, this from Medical Express. Low-dose radiation linked to increased lifetime risk of heart disease. Exposures to low doses of ionizing radiation is associated with modestly increased excess risk of heart disease, finds an analysis of the latest evidence published in the British Medical Journal. The researchers say these findings have implications for patients who undergo radiation exposure as part of their medical care, as well as policymakers involved in managing radiation risk to radiation workers and the public. A linked editorial suggests that these risks should now be carefully considered in protection against radiation in medicine and elsewhere. After taking into account other important factors such as age and exposure, the researchers found consistent evidence for a dose-dependent increase in cardiovascular risk across a broad range of radiation doses. So when they say radiation exposure is part of their medical care, they're basically meaning like CAT scans and stuff that that give you ionizing radiation.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, next up, some expanded screening recommendations for another chronic, fairly common and deadly infection in the U.S. This from MedPage Today. Screen all adults for hepatitis B, CDC says. All adults should be tested for hepatitis B virus infection at least once in their lifetime, and a wider range should get periodic retesting, according to new CDC recommendations. The report recommended moving from a risk-based approach to a universal approach in order to increase awareness of infection and reduce chronic disease and premature death. Overall, risk-based testing has been insufficient to identify persons with hepatitis B infection in the United States and has been a barrier to appropriately screening populations with a disproportionate prevalence of the disease, says Aaron Connors of the CDC's National Center for HIV Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention, as she wrote in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Currently, there are an estimated 580,000 to 2.4 million people living with hepatitis B infection in the U.S., and two-thirds of those might be unaware of their infection. An estimated 1.9 million people are chronically infected with hepatitis B, which can lead to substantial morbidity and mortality. Of note, chronic hepatitis B infection disproportionately affects people born abroad, which account for about three-fourths of the U.S. cases. People chronically infected with hepatitis B are at increased risk for liver cancer and cirrhosis and are 70 to 85% more likely to die prematurely than the general population. The current screening guidelines widen the recommendations further to recommend that anyone who requests hepatitis B testing should receive it, regardless of disclosure of risk, because many persons might be reluctant to disclose stigmatizing risks. So that's an important principle of public health, is the non-judgmental and breaking down barriers where people feel stigma. So doing a universal recommendation gets around a lot of that, as well as allowing providers who are administering the shots to do some basic education of why it's being delivered, which might educate people as far as risk factors and such. Okay, next up, a story about an interesting change in epidemiology of fatal poisonings in children. This from MedPage Today. Opioids, most common substance in young children's fatal poisonings. This didn't used to be true. Opioids were the most common substance contributing to fatal poisonings among children aged 5 years and younger in recent years, researchers reported. Examination of 731 poisoning-related fatalities from 2005 to 2018 in young kids reported to the National Fatality Review Case Reporting System showed that opioids were involved in 346 of the fatal cases, or 47% of all cases. Many toxic substances can harm children, so it is truly striking how just one class of substances was implicated so frequently in child poisoning deaths. These findings provide additional support evidence of how the opioid epidemic has not spared our nation's infants or young children. The researchers explained that although regulatory changes have improved the safety of over-the-counter medications, a substantial proportion of pediatric fatalities are still associated with over-the-counter medications. In their study, over-the-counter medications for pain, cold, and flu were involved in 15% of fatalities. In addition, the researchers said, although certain medication safety initiatives have shown promise in reducing poisonings, such as the adoption of unit dose packaging, such approaches do not address illicit opioids or all prescription opioids. 42% of deaths occurred among infants, and nearly two-thirds occurred at home. And next up, some news that will enter another drug into the annals of useless drugs. This from CBS News. FDA panel to reevaluate the most common over-the-counter decongestant, phenylephrine, criticized as useless. The FDA plans to ask a panel of its outside advisors to consider whether the most common decongestant ingredient available over-the-counter, phenylephrine, is effective. There has been a renewed petition to pull it from store shelves over studies showing it is no more effective than a placebo in pills or syrups. Of course, the placebos might be effective, but the drug that you're paying for and using, which has also other side effects, may be as effective as nothing. The April meeting of the FDA's Non-Prescription Drugs Advisory Committee will weigh whether the agency should revoke oral phenylephrine's classification as, quote, generally recognized as safe and effective, because it may be ineffective. That could pave the way for the FDA to upend the market for the over-the-counter congestion remedies, undoing a 2007 meeting of the same panel that had sided with evidence suggesting, quote, it may be effective in its current formulation, and calling for more studies of higher doses.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment, from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones, from daily sexism that can't be mansplained away, from endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Next up, a truly fresh perspective. The story will definitely make the greatest hits list and the next greatest hits production that I put together. This is a great example of how larger forces, often called social determinants in our culture, can have profound effects over the long period of time. It also might be a good critique of capitalism. This from Medical Express. All work, no independent play. Cause of children's declining mental health, says study. Anxiety and depression among school-age children and teens in the United States are an all-time high. Sadly, in 2021, child and adolescent mental health was declared a national emergency. Although a variety of causes are thought to contribute to this decline in mental health, a new study by three prominent researchers specializing in child development point to independent child's play. Findings published in the Journal of Pediatrics suggest that the rise in mental health disorders is attributed to a decline over decades in opportunities for children and teens to play, roam, and engage in activities independent of direct oversight and control by adults. Although well-intended, adults' drive to guide and protect children and teens has deprived them of the independence they need for mental health, contributing to record levels of anxiety, depression, and suicide among young people. Parents today are regularly subject to messages about the dangers that might befall unsupervised children and the value of high achievement in school, but they hear little of the countervailing message that if children are to grow up well-adjusted, they need ever-increasing opportunities for independent activity, including self-directed play and meaningful contributions to family and community life, which are signs that they are trusted, responsible, and capable. They need to feel they can deal effectively with the real world, not just the world of school, said David Bjorklund, co-author and professor in the Department of Psychology in Florida Atlantic University. The study also showed that children's freedom to engage in activities that involve some degree of risk and personal responsibility away from adults also has declined over the decades. Risky play, such as climbing high into a tree, helps protect children from developing phobias and reduces future anxiety by boosting self-confidence to deal with emergencies. Among the many constraints that impact independent activity in children today, identified in the study, include increased time they spend in school and on schoolwork at home. Between 1950 and 2010, the average length of the school year in the U.S. increased by 5 weeks. Homework, which was once rare or non-existent in elementary school, is now common, even in kindergarten. Moreover, by 2014, the average time spent in recess, including any recess associated with the lunch period for elementary schools, was just 27 minutes a day, and some schools have no recess at all. The researchers suggest that increase in school time and pressure to achieve over decades may have impacted mental health not just by detracting from time and opportunity for independent activities, but also because of fear of academic failure or fear of insufficient achievement as a direct source of distress. Unlike other crises, such as the COVID epidemic, this decline in independent activity and hence mental well-being in children has crept up on us gradually over decades, so many have barely noticed it, said Bjorklund. Moreover, unlike other health crises, this one is not the result of a highly contagious virus, but rather the result of good intentions carried too far, intentions to protect children and provide what many believe to be better, interpreted as more, schooling, both in and out of actual schools. Well, my summation would be this, that a culture that is increasingly driven to define human beings as economic beings based on their mere utility is antithetical to this whole idea of unsupervised play and experimentation that is important for developing well-adjusted human beings. And obviously a lot of that happens in childhood, although I think that adults can benefit from play as well. Okay, next up, a story on gender equality and its benefits, this from Medical Express. Greater gender equality could help both women and men live longer, says study. The first global study to investigate how gender equality may be associated with life expectancy has found that both women and men live longer as it improves. However, variations between countries grouped into regions according to socioeconomic development and geographic proximity suggest that while mainly benefiting women's lives and health at first, progress in gender equality helps men to live longer lives as well, eventually narrowing the gender gap in life expectancy. Many of the factors that determine how long you will live, like working and living conditions, exposure to pollution, access to health care, education, income, and social support, are layered with gender differences around the world. As countries make greater progress toward gender equality, and women are afforded the opportunity to participate more fully in political, economic, and social life, the whole of society reaps the rewards. Among the three dimensions included in this study, that is, political, economic, and educational, gender equality in education had the strongest association with longer life expectancy for both women and men. This suggests investing in education is paramount, particularly in low and middle-income countries, where many girls are still denied access to education and resources are limited. Even high-income countries, where substantial progress has been made to address gender inequalities in recent years, investing in gender equality may still benefit life expectancy, particularly for men. This study confirmed that what we've already been seeing in countries in the EU using a different index, reinforcing the validity of our findings. So I've said this before and I'll say it again. If you were to pick a single metric for the health of a population, gender equality would be a pretty good start. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up, I have a story on corporal punishment. I've reported on things like spanking and stuff that parents administer and how this is universally understood by experts and researchers to be bad for children and families. This one focuses on what happens in schools. This from pointer.org. It's legal in 15 states for teachers to hit your child. 7 more states take no stand. Schools, mostly in the South, are still hitting children under what is euphemistically called corporal punishment. Note that 16% of the physical punishment doled out by children to children by schools involves children with disabilities. Black students are twice as likely to be legally hit by an adult in authority than white students. Across 5 states, 851 preschoolers were physically disciplined in a single year. The Shorenstein Center for Media, Politics, and Public Policy has assembled a collection of research on this issue to help journalists report on why school administrators hit black children more often than other children. Here are the opening paragraphs of that report. Despite academic studies noting the harms associated with corporal punishment, U.S. public schools use it to discipline tens of thousands of students each year, according to data from the U.S. Department of Education. Public schools in 22 states reported using physical discipline to control student behavior during the 2017-18 academic year, the most recent year for which national data is available. 28 states have banned corporal punishment in public schools, but 15 have laws giving public schools explicit authority to use it, and 7 states have no laws allowing it or prohibiting it, according to a September 2022 report from the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights. Meanwhile, corporal punishment is legal in all private schools except for those in Iowa and New Jersey. The practice was most common in Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. That year, public preschool programs, which are often housed within public elementary schools, report using corporal punishment on a combined 851 children aged 3 to 5. Black students receive corporal punishment more than twice the rate of enrollment, and American Indian or Alaska Native students receive corporal punishment almost twice the rate of enrollment. Now, a piece of context. Of all the members of the United Nations, only one, the United States, did not ratify the 1989 treaty that protects children from, quote, all forms of physical or mental violence, injury or abuse, neglect or negligent treatment, maltreatment, or exploitation. Most countries adopted it more than 3 decades ago. Here's what global research says about physically violent punishment. Some studies found that normative physical punishment and child aggression had links to delinquency and spousal assault in later life. America's interest in spanking, whipping, or paddling children hit a high point in 2014 when NFL running back Adrian Peterson was indicted for hitting his son with a switch. After a plea deal, Peterson ended up with 80 hours of community service and a $4,000 fine for misdemeanor assault. But as the Brookings Institute notes, perhaps America lost interest because most Americans hit their kids, and most think that this is the way it should be. More than 70% of Americans agreed in 2012 that it is sometimes necessary to discipline a child with a good hard spanking. Brookings notes, in terms of altering children's behavior in the short run, physical punishment is mostly effective. But children spanked frequently and or severely are at higher risk for mental health problems, ranging from anxiety and depression to alcohol and drug abuse, according to some research studies. Children whose parents hit them regularly may also develop more distant parent-child relationships later on. There is also robust evidence of an increased incidence of aggression among children who are regularly spanked. What do you know? People learn what they live. Well, next up, I have a story that's rather interesting that it points out that in disorders that are related to body image, one that has received a lot less attention than the common ones like anorexia and bulimia. This from Medical Express. Body dysmorphic disorder is more common than eating disorders like anorexia and bulimia, say researchers. While eating disorders have been widely publicized for decades, far less attention has been given to related condition called body dysmorphic disorder. Body dysmorphic disorder is often hidden from public view due to the shame people feel about one or more parts of their body. Yet it is devastating. It is a devastating, debilitating psychological condition. People with the disorder suffer from obsessive thoughts and repetitive behaviors related to their appearance. Whereas people with eating disorders might view their underweight body as too fat, those with body dysmorphic disorder see themselves as ugly or disfigured, even though they appear normal or attractive to others. Body dysmorphic disorder is more common in both men and women than bulimia or anorexia. About 2.5% of women and 2.2% of men in the U.S. meet the criteria for body dysmorphic disorder. That's higher than the prevalence of generalized anxiety disorder, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder than in the general population. For comparison, at any point in time, bulimia is seen in roughly 1.5% of women and 0.5% of men in the U.S., and anorexia about 0.35% of women and about 0.1% of men. People with body dysmorphic disorder and those with eating disorders share similar negative emotions, such as shame, disgust, and anger about their appearance. They also engage in some similar behaviors, such as mirror checking, taking photos to check themselves, seeking reassurance from others about their appearance, and using clothing to camouflage or conceal perceived defects. People who suffer from these disorders commonly avoid places and activities due to the self-consciousness about their appearance. In addition, those with eating disorders and body dysmorphic disorder may lack the knowledge that their body image beliefs are in fact distorted. Depression is common in people with body dysmorphic disorder, and they have a higher rate of suicidality than those with eating disorders, including thoughts about committing suicide and suicide attempts. Although both eating disorders and body dysmorphic disorder can be severe and life-threatening, people with body dysmorphic disorder on average experience more impairment in daily functioning than those with eating disorders. Wow. Research indicates that 66% of people with body dysmorphic disorder have received cosmetic or dermatological treatment. However, even when people feel better about one part of their body after surgery, the image obsession often moves to one or more other body parts. Some patients will have multiple procedures on the same body part. Other people are so disappointed by the result of their surgery that they want to commit suicide. Tragically, many people with body dysmorphic disorder think about killing themselves, and others attempt to take their own lives. Approximately 80% of people with body dysmorphic disorder experience lifetime suicidal ideation, and between 24 and 28% have attempted suicide. Often, they are young men and women who feel so hopeless about their perceived appearance defects that suicide seems like the only way to end their suffering. About one-third of people with a disorder obsess about their perceived flaws for 1 to 3 hours a day, nearly 40% for 3 to 8 hours a day, and about a quarter or more about 8 hours a day. Most people with body dysmorphic disorder know they spend too much time thinking about their appearance, but others with a condition mistakenly believe that it's entirely normal to worry about their appearance for hours every day. The exact causes of body dysmorphic disorder are unknown. Possible developmental causes include genetic factors, childhood bullying, and childhood teasing about appearance and competency, as well as childhood maltreatment and trauma. Other factors that could play a role include growing up in a family with an emphasis on appearance, perfectionistic standards concerning appearance, and exposure to high ideals of attractiveness and beauty in the mass media. Common personality traits among people with body dysmorphic disorder include perfectionism, along with shyness, social anxiety, low self-esteem, and sensitivity to rejection and criticism. Fortunately, there are effective treatments for people with body dysmorphic disorder. Cognitive behavioral therapy and medication are both used to treat the disorder. Okay, next up, a story on the collective experience of Americans with American healthcare, so-called healthcare. This from Medical Express. Poll finds more Americans worried about healthcare understaffing. Healthcare has witnessed the greatest recent increase in consumers affected by staffing shortages, more so than retail, hospitality, education, customer support, and manufacturing, poll results show. More than a third, 35% of people, noticed or had been affected by healthcare staffing shortages at the time of the February poll, up from 25% last November, noted Kathy Steinberg, Vice President of Media and Communications Research at the Harris Poll. These shortages have hampered people's ability to receive medical care. More than 4 out of 5 U.S. adults, or 84%, have tried to get health care in the past 6 months. And of those, nearly 3 in 4, or 73%, experience delays or challenges in getting the care they need, the poll shows. Further, more than half of the poll's participants, 52%, said they're worried they won't be able to get needed medical care because of staffing shortages. Experts say that U.S. healthcare has been experiencing workforce issues for some time now, but the pandemic exposed and worsened those issues. We've had a healthcare workforce crisis in this country for a long time. It predated COVID, said Sophia Tripoli, director of the Center for Affordable Whole Person Care for Families USA, a nonprofit health consumer advocacy group. Tripoli chalks up many of the ongoing problems to the corporatization and consolidation of American healthcare, as independent hospitals and clinics were scooped up by regional chains and healthcare networks. We've seen a lot of data after these mergers and acquisitions about reductions in wages and changing conditions in the workforce as private equity comes in and looks at where they can maximize revenue, Tripoli said. It's been problematic in terms of the quality of care, in terms of the number of hours the workforce is expected to work. It's really a major driver in burnout. Yep, if we're going to get a handle on this runaway for-profit system, we're going to need an everybody in, nobody out, one system for all. Well, that's the only way you're going to get a hold of this, I think. That would be healthcare for all.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
And last up, have a story that would qualify as some good news, very interesting one from Medical Express. Black people in rural areas have greater mental health resiliency than white people, finds study. Black people living in rural areas of North Carolina were found to have better mental health than white people despite their exposure to various forms of racism and discrimination. This paradoxical finding is reported by researchers at Georgetown University and their colleagues in the journal Social Science and Medicine, Mental Health. White Americans commonly report worse mental health than black Americans. But we wanted to know if this pattern would occur in rural areas, where all residents experience barriers to mental health and well-being. Interestingly, when white Americans' expectations of advantage go unmet, they are potentially susceptible to poor health outcomes, and that is what we think would be going on with rural white residents' relatively worse mental health. So there you go. Black resiliency, white fragility. Soak it in, people. You're listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is just for the health of it. Okay, that brings us to our final segment, the bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increase enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. We have 25 bonus articles this week. First up, number one article, A History of Smoking and How We're Making the Same Mistakes with Vaping. So this falls under the category of lessons unlearned and history repeating itself. Of course, a lot of recent reporting I've done, there was some hope at the beginning that vaping would not be as dangerous as smoking, but it looks like the risks are more similar than they are different. Bonus article 2, study finds alarming rates of nicotine in sports. Now, some of this might have to do with vaping in younger folks, and it is associated with more team sports. And some people hope to get some competitive advantage with nicotine, but nicotine has its own health risks. So another thing to take a look at. Bonus article 3, mental health, how living in the city and country compare. So this is just taking kind of the rural-urban divide here from a mental health perspective and seeing what some of the benefits and risks are. The answer is that it's complicated. It's not obvious one or the other is advantages and disadvantages. But if you're interested with that question, how living in a city or the country compare regarding mental health, bonus article 3 is for you. Article 4, does it matter where COVID-19 came from? Pretty obvious question. My take has always been on this, that I think we're setting this as an either-or type of thing when people say, is it the lab leak or did it, arise from, transferring from a bat in the wild or whatever? Where it matters, where it comes from, yes and no. But we should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We can make sure that these high-security biolabs are actually high-security, which leads us to article number 5. COVID-19 lab leak fight obscures the global rise of high-security biolabs. So the fact is, there has been a rise in the number of high-security biolabs in a recent decade or so, and that's something we should all be concerned about. There's a reason why they need to be high-security. They're dealing with very dangerous infectious agents. So let's take care of that. I mean, what if all those people who were convinced that it was a bio leak found out that it happened, just naturally from a bat to a human being? Would that mean we shouldn't be concerned about biolabs? No. I think regardless of that ever happening, regardless of the COVID pandemic ever happening, we should be very concerned about biolabs. And it's not based on some conspiracy theory. It's based on the fact that there's a reason why they need to be high security. Bonus article 6, multiple COVID variants found in New York rats. Now, of course, you have to, part of the methodological questions is defining rats in New York City, but they did find the original variants, they found the Delta variant, and there's these older variants that are pretty much, are a fraction of a fraction of a percent of what's going around now in human beings, tends to be overtaken by the next latest and greatest variant. But in animal populations, in this case rats in New York City, these COVID variants survive. And these pools of COVID that are in animal reservoirs will continue to be a problem for infectious disease control in the future. Yes, our world now with COVID in it. Okay, Article 7. Indoor air is full of flu and COVID viruses. Will countries clean it up? So this is a good comparison of what other countries are doing. Deals with the U.S. and a bunch of other countries. And probably represents one of the better opportunities because it doesn't take care of just COVID, but I mean, there are a lot of indoor air quality issues that could be dealt with by better ventilation or filtration. And whether that's from high CO2 concentrations, which I've reported on can be dangerous, can limit the way we think, like in schools, for instance, or businesses. And, of course, all your infectious diseases, from the cold to the flu to the COVID to allergies. I mean, all these type of things could be improved by improving indoor air quality. So it's a big win on a lot of fronts. Bonus Article 8. Organization publishing now infamous mask review addresses widespread, inaccurate, and misleading interpretations. Hopefully this will be the last thing I report on this. But this the Cochrane organization, which produces the Cochrane reviews, this mask review that's been touted by anti-maskers as saying we don't really think that masks work. They're basically saying that's inaccurate and misleading. And they also do take some responsibility and are going to work with the authors to try to better put it in the plain language abstract, which is the very short version of what the entire article is that gets into the whole detail of limitations and stuff, to make that better reflect the average person off the street who would read it, how they would see that. So science communication is an important thing. It's part of why I'm here, trying to sort through all this. Bonus Article 9, how publication bias threatens research integrity and public health. So this is another kind of research methodology geek out. But basically publication bias means that research studies that show an effect are way, way, way more likely to be published. If you had 5 studies, 4 of them didn't show an effect and one of them did, that one study would likely be published. And it leads to the impression, when you look at the published literature, it gives you the impression that these effects are large and real, when in fact they may not be large or they may not be real at all. So that's an institutional issue that has to be dealt with in the research community. And another one on medical journals and researchers, bonus article 10, leading American medical journal omits black research, reinforcing legacy of racism in medical knowledge. So this is the journal, the American Medical Association, which over 100 years ago basically segregated, and based on that segregation, black doctors formed the National Medical Association and their own journal. And if you look at the cross-publication and citations between these two, it's pretty clear that black researchers are not getting their due. And this is a continued legacy of over a century of segregation in medical sciences. Bonus Article 11, how one medical school became remarkably diverse without considering race in admissions. So, you know, this is kind of one of those little teaser titles for an article, a little bit even kind of clickbaity in my view, but basically it's not a singular simple answer. It's the fact that what they did was made their medical school inviting and accessible to people of color. That's not done easily. There's a lot of things you have to do that, but when you do that, you get plenty of people of color in admissions. Bonus Article 12, Medicaid expansion reduced black-white disparities in preventable hospital visits. This is a good example of just basic access, people having health insurance when the Medicaid expansion way disproportionately affects black folks, particularly southern blacks in the U.S., are people who don't have the Medicaid expansion. Actually, the ones that still often don't have Medicaid expansion, but as a country as a whole, that's also true. So when you expand Medicaid, it's particularly targeted toward reducing black-white disparities. And bonus article 13 is another interesting one on racism. And I kind of picked it because it's about pedestrian safety. And as somebody who doesn't own a car, my life as a pedestrian is something I contemplate a lot. This article is Structural Racism and Pedestrian Safety. Historical redlining increases contemporary pedestrian fatalities. So if you look at the historical redlining of communities that happened even, you know, 80 plus years ago, this is actually associated with pedestrian fatalities today. And this is true when you look, it's a kind of a dose response depending on the gradation of redlining there is. The more redlining there was, the more dangerous it is for pedestrians today. So this is generations after the redlining. And it just shows you why racism is structural. It's, you can't just decide one day to change a policy and everything's better. There are structural changes that you have to make up for to remove those discrepancies. Bonus Article 14. Black patients dress up and modify speech to reduce bias. So this was a California study, and it looked like a third or more of blacks intentionally did things like dressing up or modifying their speech, specific strategies to try to mitigate the bias that they experience in the healthcare system. Now, of course, that's a normal reaction to an abnormal situation. But it truly sucks that the people who, you know, have to cope with all these biases, it would be a much better solution to just reduce those biases at all and not make the victims make up the difference or try to make up the difference. Bonus Article 15. Feds move in to rein in prior authorization, a system that harms and frustrates patients and providers. So this is with the Medicare Advantage, which I've been railing against a lot because it well deserves that. And this is bad for both patients, the people who have Medicare Advantage, and the providers, because they're the ones that have to deal with all the bureaucracy behind the scenes about prior authorization, which is kind of a frustrating enigma in many cases. So that's good. If we can get rid of prior authorization, that's a big advantage. But there are many ways that Medicare Advantage can take advantage of you. That's what the advantage is. It's not your advantage. It's their advantage. Article 16, denied by artificial intelligence, how Medicare Advantage plans use algorithms to cut off care to seniors in needs. So this is really literally, you know, the individual patient against the algorithm. Because these Medicare Advantage plans do these algorithms that are based on population data and then apply it to an individual and then basically say, you know, you're projected to be okay in 16 days. So therefore, we're not paying you on day 17, even though you can't walk, you know, and live independently. We're kicking you out of the hospital or the rehab facility or whatever. I mean, it's just crazy. But that's, you know, hey, it's profitable, so it must be worthwhile, right? Article 17. AMA Surgeon General propose ways to prevent doctor burnout / moral injury. I added the moral injury because this is a decent article about talking kind of really what's at the forefront of what we're trying to do, good, bad, or indifferent about doctor burnout. But I was a little disappointed that the conversation hasn't moved to include more talk about moral injury. Because burnout and moral injury, while related, are not the same thing. And much of for-profit medicine, and the reason why physicians and other healthcare workers leave the healthcare field is because of moral injury, that they cannot do what kind of the prime directives of their profession is. Okay, 18, get to a little bit more. We got a couple here that articles in the last few here that are more individual health here. Bonus Article 18. Prostate cancer treatment can wait for most men. So this we've basically known for a while, but this was a big study that came out. And the thing is, probably the best way to say this is that way more people die with prostate cancer than die of prostate cancer. So if you look at 15-year mortality, basically there's no difference in overall mortality whether you observe or treat. So obviously, I mean, prostate cancer tends to be slow growing. So this is something that's true, except of course if you've got very aggressive or late stage. But for much of prostate cancer, it's better just to wait, watch and wait. Okay, bonus Article 19. Females of all ages and ethnicities have more salt-sensitive hypertension than males. So a pretty high proportion of people are salt-sensitive, meaning they are particularly sensitive to salt increasing their blood pressure. And this seems to be true for more women than men. Article 20. Why are women more affected by plastic pollution and how can they be protected? Partly this is because women are exposed to more plastic pollution. A lot of this has to do with, you know, cosmetics and that type of thing. But also women have a different physiology that can be more susceptible to the harms of plastic pollution. Article 21, how fake sugars sneak into foods and may be disrupting metabolic health. So there's been a growing body of evidence that these non-sugar alternatives, quote, fake sugars, are actually disrupting metabolic health and could be creating a problem. Now, this is a growing body of evidence. I don't know if we're really sure how large of an effect. I think there probably is an effect. This is a good overview of that. If you're concerned about such things, if you use fake sugars, to me personally, I would apply the precautionary principle. I think there's enough evidence that probably would not use fake sugars just because there's enough evidence saying that there's harm. The best thing to do is just avoid it. Okay, bonus article 22. Six former Phillies died from the same brain cancer. We tested the turf they played on and found dangerous chemicals. Now, normally I don't follow or report much on like cancer clusters, but this is a Philadelphia Phillies baseball team, and this is back in the day, so to speak, in the 60s, 70s, early 80s. And the turf that they were playing on has a bunch of dangerous chemicals, so they were practicing. You know, they basically, that was their workplace, you know, their home field, literally. And they had way more cancer than you would expect in that population. And in a related article 23, toxic chemicals we consume without knowing it. I've reported on this type of stuff a lot, but this is, again, another good kind of basic rundown of a lot of the toxic chemicals that are just in our life that we consume without knowing it. So if you're interested in such a thing, that's a good article to check out. But I'm going to close with two good stories. 24, good news. Some toxic insecticides are vanishing from the atmosphere. So this is the Great Lakes in Michigan in particular. They actually banned a number of insecticides a decade or more ago, and they're starting to see that this is having an effect, and these insecticides are actually starting to decrease even to non-detectable levels in some cases. So, hey, you know, it might take a while to turn this boat around, but it's possible to turn around. And last but not least, bonus article 25. Jimmy Carter took on the awful guinea worm when no one else would and triumphed. So this wasn't when he was president. This was when he ran the Carter Center and taking on a neglected disease, a neglected public health problem, which of course includes almost any problem that's predominantly in the, quote, third world. I like to say the two-thirds world. But for sure, it's good that people take an interest in these, because that's part of public health, is we don't value lives differently. We value lives equally, and we shouldn't be saying, oh, we'll take care of these special people a lot more than those people. So way to go, Jimmy Carter. You can view these and all the stories I've reported on this episode and previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that is toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-